IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. My name is Sudarshan and I am a junior research scholar at the Takshashila Institution, working on a project titled 20 Million Jobs. I also have with me Anupriya, who is my colleague in the same project. Our guest for today is Riya, a researcher in the field of economics who has a demonstrated history of working in the think tank industry. Riya is currently working as an independent development consultant and researcher and is also an incoming MPhil student at the University of Cambridge. Her work experience also spans several well-known organizations such as the Observer Research Foundation, the Office of Honorable Member of Parliament Gaurav Gogoi, Center for Policy Analysis, among others. Today, we have invited Riya on this podcast to discuss in detail her paper on gender and gig jobs. In this paper, Riya scrutinizes gig jobs platforms from gendered lens and outlines the gaps that bar women's inclusion in gig work and provides helpful recommendation. Hi, Riya and Nanu. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much.
As always, fun to be joining you, Sudisha. And hi, Riya.
Hi, I'm very excited to be here.
Cool. Awesome. So let's just dive into the first question. So let's start with the state of gig jobs in India. Riya, why do you think that despite the rise of gig jobs in India, why do they still fail to see adequate participation by women? What are some structural barriers impeding them from doing these jobs?
Hi, thanks for the question. So gig jobs in India are, you know, the economy is booming. And it has been booming since Flipkart was a sole aggregator in 2010. Till the point where Niti Aayog has estimated that by 2030, the number of people employed in gig work would be around 22.5. And the industry would be valued at around $455 billion by 2024, as per a report by Asita. And a part of the charm of gig work, or you know, why it's supposed that women would be especially interested and would help with women moving into the workforce, is because it's supposed to be flexible. The flexibility offered by gig platforms, it allows workers to better manage unpaid care and paid work. So it lets workers, especially women, determine their work hours, and it reduces dependence on a static physical space. So it was assumed that more women would enter the workforce, which will lead to their increase in the labor force participation rate. But the problem has been that statistically there has been little to no improvement. And the evidence of this is as per the TASMO Gig Index, which currently registers around 28% of women in the gig economy in India, which is way less than what could have been given the flexibility argument. One of the main reasons, actually, that gig work has been unable to capture women moving to the workforce is that there are structural barriers that the gig work has been unable to address. So it has been moving around these barriers instead of addressing them. And at the onset only, the first barrier is that, you know, for any sort of work that you have to do on a platform, the thing that you require the most is owning a mobile or a smartphone and having access to internet, right? But the GSMA Mobile Gender Gap Report of 2022 reported that only 30% of women in India are mobile internet users. And weirdly, the reason is that owning mobiles and using the internet has certain socio-cultural restrictions to it. To the point where a car panchayat at one point banned women from using phones. And indeed, in this report as well, you know, family not supporting women to own a mobile phone as well as use the internet is the main reason why women don't own a mobile phone. So that's one of the biggest barriers, right, that there is an unequal access to digital technologies, which of course would not let you move into gig work. But what other, you know, opportunity is said to be for gig work is that it's an equal opportunity provider, in the sense that, you know, machine learning, because gig work is basically, you know, platforms are basically string of codes that are written that so they'll be unable to discriminate or there'll be no biases between like workers on basis of their gender. But the thing is that all these codes are written by humans, and AI, of course, learns our behavior, and you know it just works according to how we would choose workers. So, for instance, if there's a historically masculine job, for instance, carpentry or plumbing, then the algorithm of a platform would show the customer only men who might be the service providers instead of listing down women. And that's because as customers, we have often only chosen men for those jobs. Similarly, when it comes to beauty services, which is an historically feminine job, you would only find women being listed for that job instead of men. So because, you know, all these platforms are based on AI or machine learning, which learns our behaviors, it also imitates them and can actually reinforce biases. So the two main hurdles or structural biases that, you know, gig work has completely been unable to address are these two. But one thing that remains still is very deep-rooted in patriarchy, which is that it's supposed to welcome more women because it's a flexible job. So women can take care of paid work as well as unpaid care work. And the truth of the matter is that for a lot of women, this work is their primary supplementary, you know, source of income. So they can't really remove themselves or, you know, just show up for a certain number of hours in a day, because that affects their ratings, that affects the, you know, the where they are on the rank that they are on when the list of service providers are shown. So which means that there's no flexibility provided as such. And the idea that, you know, because they have to manage unpaid care work at home, it still exists, which means that instead of recognizing, redistributing, and reducing the load of unpaid care work, it's just trying to go around it, which again is the same point that, you know, gig work has been unable to address these structural barriers and has just been trying to find ways around them, which of course means that women can't leave their work at home, or women can't access digital technology, or women are inherently discriminated against on the platforms, and hence they've been unable to move into the workforce through gig economy.
So that's actually very interesting. And we're just going to focus on the platform bit that you talked about, because a lot of the availability of gig work is very platform dependent. And in your research paper that you wrote for ORF, you mentioned that the platformization of gig jobs has failed to increase female labor force participation in India, despite its advantages, right? For men, it has been a really good source of jobs, but for women, it's not doing the same thing. So, I mean, just going into detail on that a bit, can you give some examples maybe and tell us why the platformization of gig jobs is not really working for women, but at the same time, it's working for men?
I mean, it somehow lies in these same reasons, in these structural barriers and the perpetuation of gendered work still being promoted by platforms, which is why women have been unable to move into gig work as much. But I think for this particular reason, the two main barriers that platformization has been unable to, you know, accelerate the labor force participation rate for women is that, one, again, because there's been gig work is the primary or supplementary source of income for most of the women involved in gig economy. That's why they are unable to cut back on their unpaid care work at home. So the entire concept of them being able to manage their home and their outside work, and hence there wouldn't be a double burden of work on them, just fails, because there is a double burden of work still. And a lot of women, a reason for high attrition rate for women across industries has been their inability to manage household work, especially once they start a family. What you'll also notice about gig economy is that despite there being a very structured way of income coming in, there's still a pay gap that persists. So according to this report by TeamLease for delivery executives, across India, there's at least an 8 to 10% difference in the pay that women and men delivery executives receive. One more reason actually is that none of these platforms warranty safety for women. And it's not in terms of just physical safety, but also digital safety. I think the pandemic was a great example that showcased how, you know, assault against women in homes and outside have been on a rampant rise. And there needs to be a substantial legislative effort at controlling that. The problem, the good thing about employers who employ women is that there are, you know, proper legislatures like the Sexual Assault Act, which guarantee that women would be safe at least in the workplace. But for women traveling from places to places to perform their services, that safety is not warranted. Furthermore, it's not also warranted in terms of a customer could possibly assault a woman by calling them over and over again if they don't know their number, which is service provider's number, or they could generally abuse and stalk them also. And while I was writing this paper, I interviewed a bunch of women service providers, and I heard just like harrowing tales about how they had to escape abusive, not exactly abusive, but like, you know, they had to escape a very uncomfortable situation because they might be at somebody's place performing their service. And then they had to run away because there's no provision of safety that the platforms offer.
I think that's really interesting. I think what you're hinting at is structural differences on gig platforms or gig jobs is essentially carried over in some ways from what we're seeing in society, right? Like, technology or gig platforms don't miraculously solve what we've seen for generations. It brings me to my point of gig is not actually new, right? The platformization of gig might actually be new, but domestic work, especially in India, has been gigable or gig first for a really long time. And those segments, in my understanding, typically employ women more. What I found interesting about your paper also is you actually ended up looking at platforms that tend to offer more or tend to offer services that are traditionally known to be women first, like caregiving, domestic health, beauty services, etc. So my question then is, subject to these particular platforms, was there anything that you find that was working really well, or there was more that they could do as a platform? I'll just give you where my thought was. I know a lot of these platforms have introduced like SOS features where they can directly talk to a, you know, an executive. Or they don't encourage you to actually share phone numbers directly. They warn you against it. Yeah. There's a selfie verification process, etc. But I'd love to get your perspective. These platforms that are specifically working on the formalization of informal jobs that have largely employed women, what are they doing that's working, and what more could they be doing, especially because their main target audience in some ways is also women?
That's a very interesting question, actually. And I just like to point out one thing that you were completely right when you say that gig has been around for a very long time. It's just platformization that's been introduced. But platformization does not guarantee that a work would become what that was informal previously would turn into formal work. Yep. Because by definition, what formal work is that you're given social security provisions, that you're taken care of physically and mentally within the workspace. And so none of these actually do apply to any of the platforms across skills and across industries for gig workers. I did take a look at, you know, specifically those platforms that catered a lot more to, like you said, historically feminine jobs and low skilled at that matter, like low skilled within quotes. And I did that just because, like you said, this has been around for a long time. So has platformization led to better standardized ways of working for women that are involved? And what I found was that there are provisions that sometimes ensure that women involved, women service providers involved would be more cared for, like you said, SOS and, you know, like a selfie verification process. But there are so many things that they lack still. For instance, if you register as a service user in any of these platforms that I looked at, you aren't asked for a lot of verification processes. You may be asked about, okay, what's your name? Maybe, you know, tell us your phone number and your place of living, your address. But I don't think any of them went even far ahead and asked for like a government-approved ID, right? On the other hand, the verification process for the service providers is huge. It takes time. And so that's one place where there is, you know, a huge distinction, which especially puts women service providers at a little bit of a problem, right? They become a little more unsafe just by that. Then another thing is that none of these platforms have a very transparent or, you know, strong dispute redressal system, which works, which is non-biased in nature. I mean, they all have provisions which say that it's non-biased, but you know that a person with a service provider would not want to register a complaint against a service user if they know that it will affect their ratings, which is how these people get work, right? Because if you have good ratings, you'll get more jobs. A lot of times, women are even more hesitant to raise disputes because it's not just this fear of rating, but it's a lot of times they know that they need these jobs a lot more than maybe, you know, other people who are doing it, especially for women whose work this is, like, you know, it's a primary source of income. So just the idea of mobility being, you know, anyway problematic for women is being culturally apparent or culturally propagated in the country. Any steps towards raising a dispute that might hinder your mobility and your right to earn your living is very scary to women service providers, especially the ones who are doing what are historically low-skilled and feminine jobs. So the fact that no sound or transparent dispute redressal system again puts them at a disadvantage. And there have been generally like provisions ever since the Code of Social Security came into being, and it hasn't been enacted yet, but there's still some recognition for the gig workers in that. But ever since that has been done for gig workers, and I think that was very evident during the pandemic also, when, you know, some sort of medical or health insurance was provided. But I don't think it's enough, or it's anyway at par with what formal working conditions or decent job that maybe the ILO talks about. It's not there yet, and which is a long way still to go.
Okay, so before we ask a follow-up question on that, let's take a short break. Okay, we're back. Yeah, based on what you just answered, can you highlight how white-collar jobs are better than gig jobs? And can you imagine a scenario where if some of the problems that you highlighted go away with time, gig jobs can be better than white-collar jobs? Do you think that despite some of the improvements that can be implemented in the future, white-collar jobs will still continue to be more appealing than gig jobs? I would like to hear your take on that.
Yeah, so there have been a bunch of contesting arguments about this. I mean, given that there are improvements and they come to a point where gig workers are happy, there are still contesting arguments regarding the situation. And I think the biggest argument that comes in favor of white-collar jobs is that because it's a safe, decent job, you know, where you are provided with social security, where you're provided with paid vacation days, where you're provided with health and medical insurance. In the long term, when we look at gig work, when we look at the economy, it makes more sense to go for white-collar jobs. Because an economy's health is also it's not just taken by how well the GDP is doing, right? It's also taken by how decent and how well-paying the people are in the economy are. And it is supposed that people who are working in white-collar jobs or even blue-collar jobs that have like proper formal contracts are much better than ones that are informal. And at the moment, gig work is very at par with informal jobs. And in fact, you know, there's a report which stated that almost 81% of the corporations in India are already using one or two gig workers in like every single organizational division that they have, which means that there has been a trend towards this movement away from white collar to gig jobs. If things go well and, you know, gig work is actually providing all the flexibility and safety that women especially require, I think the one more thing that would be needed to do still is that flexibility shouldn't come at the cost of women still having to do all the unpaid labor at home. I think only when we are able to redistribute and recognize the unpaid labor at home. And then women have the agency to decide whether they want to go for a white collar job or they want to go for a gig job, which would be more independent in nature and which would be less, 9 to 5 working. That's the point when we can still compete both these things. And then I think it would be very individualistic in nature. But so far, it just seems that white-collar jobs, or at least something imitating white-collar jobs, is what we should go for.
That's an interesting point. I actually want to pick your brain a little bit more on that, Riya, because the fact of the matter remains, it's not like we've done amazingly well on female labor force participation in white-collar jobs either, right? So something must give. And the way that I see, at least, or gig jobs are traditionally defined, indicate, or there are factors that indicate that they might be better suited for women, like flexibility, the ability to choose what you want to do, how you want to do it, when you want to do it, etc., right? So traditionally, these are factors that we've always linked with better outcomes for women. But as you said, just because that's traditionally how gig jobs are done, the current implementation may be lacking. Leading me to my question, I found your report very interesting because you proposed a classification of workers that was similar to the UK, I believe, where there's almost like a balancing act between a gig worker or a completely independent contractor and a traditional white collar worker. I also came across a report by the Mercatus Center, which argues that the implications of policies that are trying to reclassify workers that are independent in nature to full-time or white-collar or traditional workers is actually going to have unintended consequences on women, because they will actually be more limiting for women, given that they take away traditional ideas of gig-like flexibility. I'd love to get your thoughts on how this new methodology that you're proposing actually works better. And maybe you can talk a little bit more about what are different ways for us to look at it instead of in the traditional lens that we're looking at it right now, which is all gig or all traditional. Is there a world where we can have a happy medium, perhaps portable benefits or something of that sort?
No, that was a great question, actually. Yeah, so the thing is if you do define all gig workers as employees, there'll be repercussions that might not have been, unintended consequences. And of course, the flexibility proportion, however small it might be, would be affected. And it makes sense that for the short term, at least, we're at the point where gig work has gained all those other things that we need for it to gain, for women to have that provision and decide if they want, at least in the short term, it makes sense for them to decide where they want to go for. But the thing is, the methodology that I'm suggesting actually doesn't delve into this binary. It creates three categories, and that's the one that UK is following, in which there's an independent or self-employed worker, then there is a worker, and then there's an employee. Right. So a self-employed person is maybe somebody who has a small, small grocery store or something like that. And an employee is somebody who gets the range of benefits from the employer that they're working for. The worker, which is a middle category between these two binaries, is one whose categories or whose work fall a lot in the same way like gig work falls. So, It defines those people that are working for a certain employer for a large number of hours, but who the work that they're doing, if they don't do that, the employer would be affected. And because of this, because it's associated with a certain worker for quite a number of hours and they're not able to take other work because of that, maybe because there's legislative provision in their contract because of that, maybe, or because they're just unable to do other things that normally a gig worker might. In that case, then that this middle category would be employed on the workers. So it does not cover all the gig workers who might want to, do a diverse range of activities pertaining to different platforms, but for those workers who are very closely associated with one platform. And because they're closely associated with one platform, the provisions that you provide them, the security and safety provisions that you provide them, then also should increase. For instance, among the women that I was interviewing women who were hired by this one platform called the Urban Company, right? And I asked them a bunch of times, all these other women, if they were able to do other things besides being, working as a gig worker for Urban Company. And they did show some interest about wanting to also go for individual contracts or on a personal basis to somebody else's house and provide beauty jobs for them. But they also mentioned that there's a limitation on their time, and then hence they're unable to do that. Which means that in such a scenario, when a person is completely associated with one certain company, they're supposed to get some sort of provisions by the company. And that is what this middle category asks for. There's a caveat, of course, that companies might want to label their full-time employees also in the middle category, because there'll be a difference in the security provisions or just like the benefits that they would give to the full-time employee and a worker. And so that's where maybe the civil society, or whenever hopefully we make a legislature like this, we have to think about. But you're completely right that we need to move away from these binaries and delve, maybe make labels or define things, define new categories where we're able to put in more people and provide them the benefits that they deserve.
Yeah, actually, funnily enough, I think Sudisha and I both met at Takshashila through the program that we did, which is GCPPA, and it's a 3-month course. My final assignment was on gig work and benefits.
Oh.
They make us do like a final assignment. Thank you, team, for that, which is very useful for this podcast. But something that we thought about a little bit, and I've seen policymakers also think about it, is portable benefits in general, right? Like giving gig workers the ability to choose benefits that work best for them, for all these platforms or providers, whatever, however we like to label it, come and contribute to a central fund, which workers can match. Yeah. And then they are able to use benefits according to what their needs are, because I think realistically, and it's truer in India perhaps, is everyone has completely different needs as well, right? Not everyone might need the exact same health or accidental benefits. And I found that idea very interesting, and I thought it could be a good, and I'd love to get your viewpoints on if there is potential based on your conversations for something like this to maybe work, or is this too far-fetched and theoretical at this point as well?
No, I think actually India has been doing that in some regard. So if you read the Code on Social Security, you will realize that they also talk about having a board and then having aggregators or platforms put in some contributions that the gig workers can use. So it's basically like a provident fund only. And Rajasthan was recently introduced a bill on the same, on social welfare gig workers, also has introduce the concept of creating a board where aggregators would have to put in money for the gig workers that they employ. So none of that, I think, is far-fetched in reality, and is actually a very doable thing in the present scenario. And I think the only thing that's lacking at the moment is it's not happening fast enough. I mean, the Code of Social Security was introduced, I think, in 2019. It became an act in 2020, and till date it hasn't been enacted on. So I think I think the main problem with that is that gig work and platform economy is extremely dynamic. So it's changing at every minute. And if you fail to, capture or contribute the necessary benefits that people pertaining into this economy are supposed to get, you're doing a huge imbalance, especially given the fact that it's supposed to be valued at some $455 billion in 2024, which is next year. So yeah, I think that's the only problem or the only thing that's lacking, but otherwise that's a great solution.
Okay, so that I think brings us to the last question and probably the most important question of this discussion. What are some changes that you would like to see in these platforms that provide gig jobs to people in India, not just women? And based on your research, what are some things that you can pinpoint which can especially benefit women? And do you think that they will happen at some point in the future?
I mean, I really do hope they happen. But yeah, fingers crossed for that. As for the other questions, I think 2 points that I raised earlier, one is about having a sound dispute resolution system where you give both the parties involved, which is the service user and service provider, enough space, and you do not have this idea that there'll be repercussions based on service users' arguments on the service provider. I think that's a very important thing, to have a safe dispute resolution system. Luckily, I think that at least in Rajasthan, that's happening with the new bill that they've passed and they're talking about. I think there's a provision for redressal, grievance redressal in that. The other point that I raised earlier, actually, I think that Anupriya had raised earlier was on, you know, an SOS button. I think that's also still lacking in a lot of platforms, especially for the ones that cater to, you know, house care or, you know, just like very what are conceived as low-skilled work and which also employ a lot more women than men. I think to have an SOS or emergency button system in those are very necessary because, especially because these services happen at the house of the service users, you know, at the service user's house. So there's even more bigger issue of safety involved there. Apart from that, I think there also needs some legislature changes. I had proposed in my study to for there to be a platform of platforms, which basically means a regulatory body which introduces a bunch of standardizing roles and rules that the aggregators are supposed to do. For instance, I had suggested that, like you said, like it has been suggested to gig workers that they shouldn't share their phone numbers with the service users. I had suggested that you know, sometimes recording conversations when it comes to dispute redressal is very important, but it could also become like a means for surveillance on gig workers. So having that provision, but giving that power of, you know, recording conversations and standardizing it through a platform of platforms to the gig workers, that could be one of the ways that, you know, a bunch of rules would help gig workers, especially women workers in the future. Other legislature could be that if you're not introducing different sort of contracts for gig workers involved, like you're not introducing self-employed or independent contractor and a worker and an employee, if you're still remaining in the binary, then maybe start counting them properly, right? Because I think despite the social security provision or the bill on social security, the problem is that you don't know how many people are actually involved in gig work. There has been no way of accounting that. And I suggested that one of the ways that that could be done is that you could include a new category in the NSSO surveys that happen. NSSO survey on employment and unemployment. You could include a new category. This way you're recording the number of people who are in gig work. You're not just estimating it. You also know who to, you know, you could also easily provide, there's a very simple way to access them and provide them social security benefits that you talk about in the bill itself. So I think that's also a very important thing. And lastly, especially for women, I think there has to be inclusion of a workplace security or, you know, workplace harassment laws. And if you can't, again, if you can't break the binary of work, independent contractor and employee, then what you could do is include a new provision again in the already existing laws, recognizing that the gig workers and what sort of barriers and you know, harms that they face, especially in not just in terms of physical security, but also in terms of digital security. So yeah, I think those are the main things that I hope that will happen. There has been, to be very honest, there has been positive movement towards this case. And yeah, hopefully there will be more heed given to the dynamic nature of gig work and why it needs to be urgently regulated as well as the people involved in it protected.
Yeah, thanks for answering that. And I actually had a horrible thought while listening to your answer. I was just thinking that, you know, as consumers, as women consumers, when a gig worker is supplying some service to us, I think twice before sharing my number because of the safety issue, right? But when a woman becomes a gig service provider, she has to think twice before sharing her number to the consumer. So I feel like it's such a difficult situation for women to be both consumers and service providers, right? Safety is really at the core of consumption and service provision. So that's really a horrid realization that I had. And with that, I think we should end the podcast and give our listeners something to think about.
Oh my God.
Thank you so much, Riya and Anu, for joining us. So, of course, you've given our listeners a lot more to think about gig jobs and the fact that we.
I'm not.
Now, and
I just thought, okay, of all the conversations, I can't believe I ended in a horrible mood. Oh, shit.
Let's be real. I think the biggest takeaway that I have from all of this is it doesn't matter. Like, gig is not new. And these safety concerns have existed forever, right? So
exactly.
I think it's on us, incumbent on us to do more, regardless of the fact that it is now technology first. Ideally, great technology is a disruptor, right? It creates fundamental change. So I think it's not enough for it to just recreate more of the normal. We're seeing, Ria, to your point, we're seeing some of some movement, some adaptation. But of course, like you said, there is urgency that is needed. There is urgency from the policy perspective as well. And more importantly, every time I do a podcast or think about or read about women in the workforce, it just makes me sad, like to Sudisha's point, because structural changes are needed. And that's the realization and the conclusion we always come to is no matter the path you take, informal, formal, technology, not technology, white collar gig, whatever you might say, the need for structural change doesn't go away. And that's the key, right? Like what everyone should be thinking about is once you create structural change, all of these problems actually go away.
Yeah.
So yeah, hopefully not a horrid thought to end the podcast on. Go on, Ria.
No, I was just saying that that's actually very true. And that's the entire point, right? Gig work is not going to stop. It's not going to stop rising. It's going to go and, it's going to rise. It's going to peak. All of that is going to happen. Problem still remains that it's going around all the structural barriers that exist for women and have been existing for women. So until unless it's able to address that, until unless it creates not just a societal change, where we're not just reducing the burden of unpaid care work on women, but we're also giving them more agency in terms of mobility and, deciding what to do. I think, and that of course goes to all the industries and not just gig work, but becomes more important in gig work because, like I said, it's like rising exponentially, and because it's not very well regulated, so it creates a lot of loopholes where security and safety become a huge problematic issue.
Yeah, I know we're at the tail end of it, but I just what you said in the end, I think my thought on why it's even more important we think about it in context of gig work is because of the opportunity it presents. Traditionally, the way gig work is defined is very conducive to more women into the workforce. It is more conducive to giving them opportunities. Creating technology always creates a little bit more democratization of opportunity, in my view. I may be slightly biased because I'm a big consumer, but it just, I think like that's even the bigger reason we should think about it is yes, because gig work can go around the structural barriers, but if done right, it could actually challenge some of these structural barriers. And that's maybe the note of optimism that we leave on. Sudisha, what do you think?
That's always the case, right? I see something horrible and then Anu steps in and brings some positivity. Every podcast, same thing happens.
All right. On that note, I think we're a great balancing act, and hopefully the listeners will vet that for us and say nice things about the balancing act that we are. But thank you, Ria, for joining us. It was so great. This could go on forever, honestly.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been really fun. And I do hope you're all left with some nice views and not just the horrible realities. We need to live in a bubble.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.